Welcome to the Gonzo Chronicles. I'm your host, Cyrus Alderwood, the official spokesman for Generation X. Stick around. It's going to get weird, as always. Back to another episode of the Gonzo Chronicles. So today is March 18th. Tomorrow is the first day of spring. Actually, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be cold, unfortunately. Snowflakes fell today, just a few. Nothing to write home about, nothing to brag about. But nonetheless, like jumping into spring, it's been like 70 degrees here. So it's weird. Those of you who live near me that are listening to this, you know exactly what I'm talking about. The weather is schizophrenic, but hey, that's okay. I've enjoyed some spring weather, and then now the last couple days it felt like winter. A couple more of those to go, and then we're back into the 60s, so hey, hooray for me, right? Wow. So what's going on in the news since the last podcast? Hopefully everybody enjoyed the Catching Up with Cooper episode. The brackets were picked last night. We have March Madness starting on Thursday. Love this time of year. I'm in one of those cutthroat pools where you pay your fee and pick your team out of the hat, basically. Pick your team that you're sticking with in the tournament. And the thing is, you have to beat the spread. So if I pick like a number 16 team and they're playing a number one seed, and if that 16 seed actually beats the spread, then I win. So at that point, I would take the number one seed and go to the next round of the tournament. That's just the way it works. You never know who's going to win. There's always crazy upsets. Looking forward to it. March Madness is cool stuff. But, you know, we got baseball around the corner. Really excited about that, too. Hopefully the Reds will have a decent year. Not going to hold my breath, but hopefully. And for the love of God, somebody please sign Joey Votto before he gets too bored. So, this episode of the Gonzo Chronicles, I wanted to talk about something that is kind of near and dear to my heart. That it's literally something that affects all of us every single day of our lives. It's money. I'll talk a little bit about money today. Specifically, the central bank, the Federal Reserve. There's been a conspiracy theories about the Federal Reserve going for as far back as 1800s when people were trying to develop a central bank. And there were certain powers that be politically that absolutely hated and abhorred it and did not think it was constitutional at all. People like Thomas Jefferson, people like Andrew Jackson vehemently opposed the Federal Reserve or any central bank. And central bankers from foreign countries, strongly opposed them coming into our country for influence. So there's a lot of history there. You can dive into it as much as you want. Could do some Googling and find out all kinds of information about it. But let me ask you a question. Does the formation of the central bank, the Federal Reserve, have anything to do with the sinking of the Titanic? Wow. Now that's a conspiracy theory. And this is one that's been floated around since the Titanic went down. But let's dive into a little bit of the history. Kind of keep it brief because I know the topic is a very confusing one. Now, when I say the Federal Reserve, which is our central bank that sets interest rate policy, a lot of people think that our central bank, the Federal Reserve, is part of the government. It's federal. It's got the name right there, right? So that's very misleading. The Federal Reserve is not a part of our government. It is not built into the Constitution as one of the branches, because there are only three branches of government. Nor was it necessarily anything implied, even though the reason it passed was because it was part of the implied powers, the Federal Reserve Act, that is. So a lot of people are right there confused, like, wait a minute, this is not just part of the government? No, it's not. The Federal Reserve is a private bank. It is privately owned as a central bank. I really got interested in this because those of you who know me know that I'm a history buff, love history, try to read as much as I can. But I do have a degree in my bachelor's in economics. So I was always fascinated with the concept of money, the history of economics, because money explains so many things. You always know that phrase like, well, you want to know why somebody committed the crime? Well, follow the money. That's true with everything, from world events to world wars to smaller wars that happen to our own civil war. I mean, a lot of people think it was just about slavery. Well, a lot of it was economics. Economic pressures really is what those are what started the Civil War here in America. And a lot of people don't really understand fully about how the southern states were actually offering no tariffs to any country that wanted to bring goods and services, bring goods into southern ports, because the northern ports always got all the Boston and New York and Maryland. They always got the shipments coming from overseas. Those are the main ports. Well, those goods trickled down into the South, and the South eventually got pissed off about it. And southern states along the shores, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, they were offering free shipments, like tariff-free goods to come in into the port. So they had free trade. The North did not offer free trade to other foreign entities that were bringing goods in. So some of those have thought, well, why would we pay the extra duty in the North? We could just deliver them to the South. We're still getting the same money for it, and then the goods can filter up to the North. Okay, well, that explains a lot of things when you think about the economic clashing of powers from powerhouse states like New York, Massachusetts, that were used to having all that and having the major cities and then the engine of economic growth. And then, there were so many other economic factors. I'm not going to get into a lot of that. That might be an interesting show, though, for nerds like me. But the central bank, like, you follow the money and you can follow so many things that have happened in history. So there's a really interesting book that I recommend everybody pick up and check out if you want to understand the history of the Federal Reserve and the impact it's made on our economy, good and bad, because there were certain powers that be in the early part of the 20th century and late 19th century that wanted a Federal Reserve, wanted a central bank so bad because there were so many economic opportunities afforded to them. These are huge, huge power players in American history. JP Morgan, for example. So essentially this book is called, well, the book is called The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin. It's a second look at the Federal Reserve. So why is it called Jekyll Island, The Creature from Jekyll Island? Well, Jekyll Island is nothing more than an island off the coast of Georgia. So November 20th, 1910 to November 30th, 1910, a secret gathering at a secluded island, Jekyll Island, off the coast of Georgia in 1910, laid the foundations for the Federal Reserve System. So here's essentially what happened. November 10th, or 1910, six men, they met at Jekyll Island. It was called the Jekyll Island Club. It's off the coast of Georgia, and they wrote a plan to reform the nation's banking system. So the meeting and the purpose of it, these were closely guarded secrets, folks. When these wealthy people traveled anywhere, at that time, it's like the paparazzi followed them everywhere. So if one of them left their mansion or one of them left their building in New York, There were newspaper people outside following them everywhere they went to report their every move because these were just men of power. So the fact that these men were able to secretly get away, they couldn't travel because people knew them everywhere they went. So they had to travel in secret compartments on trains and not take their own transportation the way they wanted to usually. So they couldn't like have their own train to go down there. They had to disguise themselves and take secret means of travel to get down there. So everything that they did was like closely guarded. And these people didn't admit that the meeting even happened until during the Great Depression, the 1930s. But the plan that was written on Jekyll Island laid a foundation for what would eventually be the Federal Reserve System as we know it today. These six power players were Nelson Aldrich, A. Piet Andrew, Henry Davison, Arthur Shelton, Frank Vanderlip, and Paul Warburg. So they all meet at Jekyll Island. Now, at the time, there was need for reform in the country. And let me just kind of lay a little bit of background here for you. The men who met there on the island, they believed that the banking system had a lot of problems, and it did. Their views was on this issue, they were well known. Like they didn't hide their views on the need for a central bank or their desire for one. Not before the meeting, not after the meeting, or anytime, right? Anytime they talked about it publicly, they talked about their concerns when they were at Jekyll Island, and this was in reports of the National Monetary Commission. Actually, I think that was a group that was writing about this. So, like a lot of Americans, these guys are concerned with financial panics that happened off and on a lot. And that had disrupted a lot of economic activity in the country during the whole 19th century. So there were nationwide panics that occurred on about every 15 years, probably. So those panics actually forced these financial institutions and banks to close up or stop operations or suspend or operations. And that would trigger some long and deep recessions. And American banks held large required reserves of cash, but those reserves were scattered throughout the nation, right? So it wasn't like today where you could just digitally move money from one, wire from one bank to another. These were held in vaults and of thousands of banks, I guess, across the country, or as deposits in financial institutions that were designated as reserve institutions or central reserve cities like New York or Philadelphia or Boston. But during these crises, those funds were frozen in place and it prevented them from being used to, I guess, unwind the economic situation, like prime the pump, so to speak. So during booms, banks had excess reserves. They tended to flow toward big cities, especially New York, where investors, bankers would invest them in what they call loans, which were loans repayable on demand to brokers. So the brokers in turn loaned those funds to investors speculating in stock market, whose stock purchases served as collateral for the transactions and on and on and on. So you can sort of see the dominoes lining up. The American system made bank reserves immobile, and stock markets really volatile. Like you think it's volatile sometimes today, really volatile back then. So that just sets up a lot of instability, right? So there were needs, there were problems that needed to be ironed out. In Europe, bankers there invested much of their portfolios in short-term loans to like local store owners, merchants, manufacturers. So that what they call that's called commercial paper, by the way. Commercial paper directly financed commerce and industry. And that provided banks with assets that they could quickly convert to cash during a crisis. So the European system was a lot more fluid, let's put it. So those loans remained liquid for a lot of reasons. First, the borrowers paid the financial institutions, which are usually banks, with which they probably had accounts there for a long time, had good relationships with them. And that guaranteed repayment in case the borrowers couldn't meet their obligations, right? So the second thing was the loans funded the merchandise in the process of production and sale. And that merchandise could also be used as collateral if the borrowers couldn't pay their loans. So the Jekyll Island guys, they worried about the I guess what this is a kind of an economic term, elasticity, but they worried about how inelastic the supply of money was in the US because things froze up, like I mentioned. The value of dollar was linked to gold, and the amount of currency that was out in the system was linked to the supply of a special series of federal government bonds. And the supply of currency neither really expanded or contracted with changes for demands in cash, whether seasonal changes or whatever, such as like, well, back then, like we think about the Christmas holidays now, and shopping and a lot of commerce happens in the fourth quarter of each year, and banks catch and businesses catch up and become profitable. But back then, you'd have to think about like the fall harvest, as well as like holiday shopping in large cities, right? But that caused interest rates to vary from one month to the next. Like now, we see it like it's stable for a while, and the Fed sets it, and then they can raise it or increase it. But and then there's that floating rate, obviously. But the inelastic supply of money and the limited supply of gold, really caused a lot of long and serious, economically painful deflation. Now we are dealing with inflation right now, and deflation is a fall in the price of goods and services. Now that may sound great to you and me, but that deflation is just as dangerous as inflation. You want a stable currency. So anyway, the Jekyll Island folks. Let's try to shorten the story up a little bit here, before I get lost in the. All these books I've read. Furthermore, all right, so Jekyll Island, those guys down there believe that they needed just a bunch of different arrangements in the American system. So, for example, American banks couldn't operate overseas. So, American merchants had to finance imports and exports through investment houses and financial institutions in Europe, mostly in London, actually. So they struggled to clear checks outside of the boundaries of a single city. So London was really financial hub of the world. That increased the costs of interstate commerce here in the US, and inner city commerce. And it was kind of risky and expensive and long distances, right? So when they had the one hub there, and it seemed to work in Europe, we had such long distances to cover here and no system to support it. So, in the New York Times in 1907, and this is, I think this is in the book from The Creature from Jekyll Island, Paul Warburg, who was a, if you guys can Google him, but he was very wealthy, German-born financier, and he was a partner at the investment bank of Kuhn, Loeb, and Company. And that was. He was, I guess, one of the premier experts in the world on the banking system in the US and Europe. And he wrote that the US system was about at the same point that had been reached by Europe at the time of the Medicis and by Asia. And in all likelihood of the, and this is, he said, at the time of Hammurabi. So he was saying we were so archaic and stuck in the dark ages with our banking system. But months after he wrote that, the country was struck by the panic in 1907. And you can Google that too. The panic really kind of lit a fire under Congress's ass, particularly Nelson Aldrich. He was a U.S. senator, a Republican senator. And he was a very powerful man in the country. So the chair of the Senate Finance, he was also the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. And the following year, he sponsored a bill with a guy by the name of Edward Vreeland, another Republican, and created the National Monetary Commission that I just mentioned a few minutes ago to study reforms to the financial system. So he hired a bunch of advisors to the commission. One of those was Henry Davidson, a partner at J.P. Morgan, and A. Piet Andrew, that I mentioned before, an economics professor at Harvard University. And over the next couple of years, they studied banking and the financial systems, and they visited Europe and met with bankers over there. So in the fall of 1910, Senator Aldrich was persuaded that there was a need for a central bank in the U.S. And Congress was going to start meeting in just a few weeks. So Aldrich, probably at Davidson's suggestion, the guy from J.P. Morgan, who was controlled by J.P. Morgan himself, decided to have a small group to help him kind of summarize all he learned, write it down, a proposal to establish a central bank. And that group included Aldrich, his private secretary, Arthur Shelton, Davison, and Andrew, who by then, by 1910, he was appointed the Treasury Secretary. So he was like big time important in the country too. Frank Vanderlip, who was the president of National City Bank, and former a Treasury official, Warburg, that you've always heard of Daddy Warbucks. Well, that's who we're talking about. So these were all like exclusive guys to this Jekyll Island Club. And so one of them was also J.P. Morgan himself, and he arranged for the group to use the club. And it was founded in, I read here, 1886. And it had a lot of just some of the nation's elites, such as Morgan, Marshall Field, and William Kissam, Vanderbilt, who's, they always said he had mansion-sized cottages all over the island there. There was a magazine, I can't remember the name of the magazine, but it said it was like the richest, most exclusive, and the most inaccessible club in the world. So these guys get down there, and this plan takes place, and they begin to push it and push it and push it until eventually we have what was called the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. They called it a currency bill, or the you might in history in when you were in high school, you might have heard it as the Owen-Glass Act, I think is what it's called. But anyway, it called for a system of 8 to 12 mostly autonomous regional reserve banks that would be owned by commercial banks, whose actions, and I'm reading it here verbatim, would be coordinated by a committee appointed by the president. The Federal Reserve System would then become a privately owned banking system that was operated in the public interest. Bankers would run the 12 banks, but those banks would be supervised by the Federal Reserve Board, whose members included the Secretary of the Treasury, the Comptroller of the Currency, and other officials appointed by the president to represent public interest. So they wanted to keep this politics out of this, but is that a good thing, to have not much public oversight? In recent years, you've probably heard, if you were ever heard of Rand Paul or Ron Paul, and some people on the libertarian side of the political argument calling for an audit of the Federal Reserve. That has never happened. Somebody could forcibly audit your business. You could be audited by the IRS. But no one's allowed to go in and audit the Federal Reserve. Why is that? A lot of controversy around that topic, so keep that in mind. So as I grab this book, Creature from Jekyll Island, I'm going to go over a couple of things. I've got a couple places bookmarked. By the way, everyone thinks that this was the first central bank, right? It wasn't. Actually, there's like three or four before the Federal Reserve, believe it or not. The Hamilton Jefferson conflict. This is from the Creature from Jekyll Island. Hamilton was strongly opposed by Thomas Jefferson, Hamilton's proposal for a bank. And Thomas Jefferson was then Secretary of State. And that was the beginning of this big, huge debate that happened. That actually, when Congress started to debate this stuff, this was back here in Thomas Jefferson's time, this argument for and against the central bank was, I mean, it was going on for decades. Actually, it was a central issue of the time that led to the creation of the first political parties, actually. So the Federalists at the time, they gathered around the ideas of Hamilton. The Anti-Federalists, later called the Republicans, were attracted to the ideas of Thomas Jefferson. So Jefferson pointed out, and this is verbatim here, that the Constitution did not grant to Congress the power to create a bank or anything similar. That means such power is reserved to the states or to the people. In a rebuttal to Hamilton's proposal, he said, and this is a quote from Jefferson, to take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specifically drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power, no longer susceptible of any definition. Furthermore, he said, even if the Constitution had granted such power, it would be extremely be an extremely unwise thing to do, because allowing banks to create money could only lead to national ruin. And as that has happened, we have seen, especially since the gold standard was removed, a lot of crazy inflation. Not like we haven't had inflation before, but we have a situation now where inflation's first and foremost. You can't go to the grocery store without worrying about your money. So this argument about a central bank goes way back, and it actually impacts these topics today. So one of the reasons I'm so interested in this conspiracy theory is just because it's a cool conspiracy theory, but it's sort of relevant. You know, the whole argument of money and the history of money and who has the power to control it. So anyway, Alexander Hamilton argued the other side. He said that debt was a good thing, but if it was kept within reason, and that the nation needed more money in circulation to keep up with expanding commerce. And a good point. Only the bank, he said, would be able to provide that. Furthermore, while it's true that the Constitution did not specifically grant the power to create such a bank, Alexander Hamilton said it was nevertheless one of the implied powers, because it was needed to accomplish other functions which were granted in the Constitution. So that was the end run. That's how they got around the fact that it was unconstitutional. Nothing, so it really had a lot of polarizing ideas, you know, opposite sides, and they were clashed hard. You think there's a lot of division in politics today. This would have been an interesting, to be a fly on the wall, listening to these people screaming at each other in the halls of Congress over this topic. Wow. So let me just sum it up, right? So Jefferson says that a private central bank issuing a public currency is a horrible menace to liberty, to the liberties of the people, and it's more menacing than a standing army. So he said, we must not let our rulers load us with perpetual debt. Hamilton, on the other side, so sum up his argument, he says that no society can succeed which did not unite an interest and credit of rich individuals with those of the state. A national debt, is, if it is not excessive, will be to us a national blessing. So where are we at today with the national debt? Anybody checked? $31 trillion? Our deficits are running at about $2 trillion right now, every deficit, or every budget. That's pretty dangerous stuff. Now, the size of the debt isn't really, you know, the dollar amount. It's not really the, you know, the thing to focus on, but what, just to, if you, anybody interested, you know, nerd alert here, it's the percentage of debt to GDP. We're at a huge amount. Like, our debt is bigger than our GDP now. So if it was 100%, it would be correlated. We're at like 130, quickly on our way to 150. Those are the levels where other countries have seen hyper runaway inflation and have experienced national economic collapse, depressions, total economic collapse. So we're both kind of right, maybe. But if the feds didn't do this with the Act of 1913, when then could the states somehow have done it? Possibly. It was never really given a... That argument never really opened up. It was all this or nothing. So the House of Representatives, they passed what was called the Federal Reserve Act by a vote of 298-60. And the Senate also passed it 43-25 at the time. In both chambers of Congress, it was the anti-banker Democrats at the time that overwhelmingly supported the act. While for the most part, the pro-banker Republicans opposed it, which is kind of weird. You'd think it would have been the other way around. President Woodrow Wilson signed the bill on December 23rd, 1913, and the Federal Reserve System was born. Bankers largely opposed the act. bankers, because the presence of a Federal Reserve Board in the legislation, and because of only one of its 7 members could represent the banking community itself. So big power players got a huge chunk of the seats at the table, and the little guy, so to speak, local bankers, regular banks, bankers across the country were shut out for the most part. Basically, okay, we're writing the rules now. You're going to sit down. You're going to do what you're told. Basically, is what the Federal Reserve System did to regular banks at the time. Now, the Federal Reserve System as it exists today is not exactly the same thing that was written then. So you have to understand that it has evolved over the decades. But it's undergone some rare but substantial overhauls over the years. Two of the most important changes occurred in response to the Great Depression, and then, of course, the mini crisis of the late 70s. So I'm not going to get into those, but I am going to get into like another thing here real quick, and then I'm going to shut up. I'm going to tell you about the Titanic. So after a year of like intense debate, Hamilton's views prevailed, and in 1791, Congress actually granted a 20-year charter to what was called the Bank of the United States. That was actually the second central bank, and it was modeled closely after the Bank of England, which means it was almost a damn near replica of the previous bank that they had. They tried this once before. It was called the Bank of North America. So, I guess bridging the gap, like to show it was kind of the same thing as the last one. The president of the new bank was a guy by the name of Thomas Willing, who was the same man who had been a partner to Robert Morrison, president of the old bank. Right? So, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, kind of thing. So there's a lot of things in the history of the Federal Reserve. There have been people, very prominent people, who opposed the central bank even after it came about. So I'm gonna William Jennings Bryan. Some of you probably have heard that name. You're like, where have I heard that name in history? Well, he was one of the most powerful Democrats in Congress, and this goes back, decades. But William Jennings Bryan, he opposed the Federal Reserve Act back in 1913, and he said because it would privately issue money rather than through the government, which he thought was the legal obligation of the government. He was fooled into supporting the bill when phony compromises were made, which gave the appearance of public control and government issue, but which in fact did neither. So not only is it not publicly controlled, they don't have any say so in the amount of money that's issued out either, right? So Bryan, who was I guess he was, since he was so adamantly opposed, the powers that be, I guess, to shut him up. He was rewarded with an appointment as the Secretary of State, right? So he became, as he got into the Secretary of State's position and sort of shut up about the whole thing, he started seeing how things were working. And he got so pissed off and angry by just the duplicity of his own government that he resigned after Woodrow Wilson didn't bother to warn him, didn't, or not him, but didn't bother to warn the public. That the Lusitania was actually carrying munitions. Go look that up, because that ties into a lot of the things that these power players were doing back in the day. They were very dishonest. They lied to the public a lot. And because war is a racket and a big money scam, who better to make money for the powerful people than the people running a central bank? Or average everyday bankers and small business bankers. I wonder. I mean, that's an obvious answer. Here was he said that he can actually William Jennings Bryan. He went on to make a complaint. This is a quote. He complained that it was like putting women and children in front of an army. Yeah, it's true. In recent times, Alan Greenspan, we all know him. He was appointed as the chairman of the Federal Reserve under Reagan. And served that way for a long time until he retired. And Ben Bernanke was his the guy who took his place under Bush and was there, and they called him Helicopter Ben for dropping money all over the place during that big crisis of 2007. We all remember that, 2008, 9. So Alan Greenspan, he was this guy before he got into being appointed as the chair of the Federal Reserve. Alan Greenspan was a huge, very powerful, important voice for advocating the gold standard. He was pissed when Nixon took us off of it. And he was such a system of the a critic of the system, and he said that it made us subservient to a banking cartel. Well, he was arguing the other side. Now, why would they put him in charge of the Federal Reserve? Well, that was back in the 60s and 70s. After he became director of JP Morgan, he was given that role. So to shut people up, they give you power and influence. You're one of the team now. It's kind of corrupt that way. But he was appointed to, he became the director of JP Morgan and Company, and he was appointed as chairman of the Federal Reserve in 1987 by Reagan. And then once that happened, once he was started climbing that ladder, he was silent on all those issues. And he did nothing to piss off the powers that be anymore. Because now he served that creature from Jekyll Island, as it's called in this book. So it just kind of shows, like William Jennings Bryan, even the best of people that have been against this can be corrupted by rewards in politics, and that is a very scary thing. This book has a lot of good information. It's just so deep. You can spend, like, there should be an entire podcast, about 100 episodes dedicated to tearing this book apart. So I'm not going to get into it, but I do highly recommend that if you're interested in this topic, go read it. But so the meeting at Jekyll Island, right? So they all these power players, they meet there. And you have all these big time financial people who are really pushing for this. Because like I said, if you see what happened after before after the central bank came into play and just how big this bank is now on a global scale. So there was a theory that JP Morgan planned to kill off his rivals by sinking the Titanic. What? All right, so here's the theory. And you can get there are countless videos on YouTube. Go have fun with it. So according to the theory, JP Morgan, he planned the Titanic disaster to kill off rival millionaires, Jacob Astor, Isidor Strauss, and Benjamin Guggenheim. They all died on the Titanic. So the thing is, some of these supporters of the central bank, the Federal Reserve, they all booked these, the Titanic was a big thing. All the rich people, all the wealthy, and all whoever was who's who list of people around the world, they were going to jump on the first unsinkable ship, the Titanic, right? So even people who opposed the finance the forming of the Federal Reserve, the three gentlemen I just mentioned, right? Astor, Strauss, and Guggenheim. So the theory is the fact that J.P. Morgan had originally planned to sail on the Titanic, but changed his mind shortly before it took off. Actually, several of the people who were behind forming the Federal Reserve didn't have tickets, and right before it took off, they backed out. No explanation. Just, nah, we're not going. Okay. But the people who had opposed it, well, they were on the boat. Is it convenient that the loudest voices opposing a Federal Reserve and central banking and funny money, right? Is it coincidence? I don't know. Anyway, but it doesn't offer any real explanation. None of them did about why they didn't go on there, but the ship hit the iceberg and it killed over 1,500 people. So there was, I think, 2,500 or so on the boat. So, some people survived. I mean, they had no idea who was going to survive or not. The theory is interesting because I don't believe in coincidences, but the fact, how do you know who you're going to kill or not? And why would they sink that ship? So, anyway, there was some other, opinions out there that said that Astor and Guggenheim really didn't have a position on the Federal Reserve one way or the other, and actually one of them actually supported it. But I don't think that was necessarily true. I think they were just big rivals, and they didn't want JP Morgan to succeed or some of the others. And anyway, so that was really interesting that the also who other people who were in charge supported the bank, the Rothschild banking family. And it was rumored that the Rothschilds were the ones who arranged for Astor, Strauss, and Guggenheim to be on the Titanic, or arranged their deaths there. At the time, the Washington Post notes that invoking the Rothschilds as international conspirators is a centuries-old anti-Semitic trope. The Rothschild family founded banking houses across Europe in the early 1800s, and they have been a favorite target of conspiracy theorists ever since. Well, maybe. And those theories resurface every few years. So it's really interesting that the big opponents of the central bank seem to be on the Titanic, while all the big ones who were in favor of the central bank backed out at the last minute. But I think it was I'm trying to think of there was another angle to it, but there's a lot of holes in that theory. But one of the biggest ones that the Titanic's insurance wasn't enough to cover the loss of I guess another ship that was out there, one called the Olympic. Actually, yeah, this I'm kind of recalling this now, so this is like a good insurance fraud story, but it's one of the more popular ones. This one says that someone switched the Titanic with another White Star Line ship, the RMS Olympic. But as Vice President Curator of the Titanic Museum said, this was in I think Missouri or somewhere, he said it just doesn't make any sense. So there was some theory that they switched ships at the last minute too and made it look like the Titanic. But there are so many different angles to this. The Titanic was doomed anyway. If you get a chance, go look that up though. But there are so many things in this book, The Creature from Jekyll Isle, that shows how money is grifted through central banks. And not just a little bit, I'm talking billions and trillions over time. But if you knew the central bank was going to grow that big, if you had a comparison like the Bank of London, Bank of England, for example, then why wouldn't you? Would it be worth the sinking a ship full of people? Probably. If you had a piece at that table and could control money and commerce. When you control money and commerce, you control politics. And I think these power players know that. They knew that then. It's always been the case. But nonetheless, a crazy conspiracy theory. Really interesting, though, but I'm a nerd. It was a history of money. We're dealing with a lot of inflation. And we may be dealing with it for a while. The last numbers didn't look good. They kind of ticked up. So when you have that big stimulus package that was passed a couple of years ago, with most of the money set to be released this year, usually they do that during a presidential year, an election year, because they want it to look like a lot of things are going on in their districts, a lot of money, projects happening, blah, 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 make them all look good. But when you're dealing with inflation and you've raised interest rates to where it kind of hurts people, but now the government is not helping because they're spending way too much when the so it's got one side trying to pull and the other one pushing. It's just the politicians aren't helping with their spending. They're about to make it worse, I'm afraid, but I hope I'm wrong. But nonetheless, there's a little history in money, the Federal Reserve, and how it came about. This has been argued about for decades, long before the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913. I wonder if Woodrow Wilson regrets it, because it's almost like you handed over the powers and the lever of liberty at its most basic level with money at the local level to something that's not even federal and put the name federal on it. Very dishonest. But there we have it. Hey, folks, that's another episode of the Gonzo Chronicles. I hope I haven't bored anybody to tears. Fascinating book, The Creature from Jekyll Island. You can find it on Amazon. You can actually find readings of it on YouTube. And you can find speeches by G. Edward Griffin out there in presentations on YouTube also. I think the man's dead now, but nonetheless, that stuff is out there. There are still proponents talking about this to this day. Probably find them mostly in libertarian circles. But hey, have at it. Have fun. There's a lot to be learned by following the money. Cheers, everyone. See you next episode.